took the video and put it on their own website. And it was like, oh, the video actually became more powerful than the podcast itself.
Well, than the content.
Yeah,
it's difficult.
Someone told me that video is the future, but I don't know if that's true.
I've not seen it catch on yet.
It's not one for me.
Believe it when I see it.
Right, I'm going to jump straight into introduction. So this week we have Henry DeZoet, who I'm going to say you're a friend of the show. That's already, yeah. The reason we wanted you on, you've got such an interesting background, which I'm going to repeat some of the stuff we talked about, but you founded The Big Deal in 2014. Then in 2018, you created Look After My Bills. And then something we're very excited to talk to you about. You then went on Dragon's Den, which we will talk about, which was great. And it was such a baller episode. And it was great. And then you sold that to Go Compare. And I'm jumping through your whole career very, very quickly. You've also been a special advisor at the Department of Education. You're now a non-executive director at the Cabinet Office and Hornby Models, which I would say is about as interesting as a career can be over the last 10 years, right?
That's very kind.
But you're now an angel investor. That's what I'm going on your Twitter bio here. Is that how you describe yourself as an angel investor?
I mean, it kind of totally pained me to put that on my Twitter and LinkedIn profile, but... that is probably what I spend most of my time doing at the moment. And putting it on there meant that I get more deal flow. So more people send me deals or know that I'm doing this kind of stuff or approach me directly. And I love it when people approach me directly. I try and reply to everybody.
What's your Twitter handle, Henry?
It's ZoetH, Z-O-E-T-H, I think. Well, maybe it's H2.
You don't have your phone.
I don't have my phone. I couldn't get to Zoot, so that was annoying.
And say, if anyone listens to this, they might approach you with some brilliant opportunities. Is there a particular niche that you would say you are the smart money for that you get excited about? Because when you talk about it, it actually seems quite diverse. The idea and the people seem most important.
Yeah, I'm definitely dumb money. I mean, like, so I probably, I'm investing at kind of pre-seed and seed, so it's very early. And so you're absolutely right. It's much more about the person and the founders and their drive. And often actually the idea isn't even necessarily that important because at that very early stage, it's going to change. You know, like my business pivoted dramatically. And I expect, you know, most startup founders at that early stage will do that. And it's therefore just the ability then to see the way forward and also just to keep going, because a lot of this is just about being relentless and working hard and all of that. I mean, obviously some ideas are ridiculous and you don't go for it.
That does bring me on. I mean, by far the biggest thing that's ever happened in your career is going on Dragon's Den. For me, you know.
A ridiculous idea.
The Cabinet Office, sure. You know, Matt, non-exec of Hornby, you know, going on telly. That's what I want to ask about. We rewatched it last night.
It was so good.
It was so good. I can't believe what a great deal you got. I can't believe how sort of articulate you both were in the room. I can't believe how pissed off Peter Jones looked. Tell us about it.
Well, the thing with Peter was that, so also we went in at about 10 in the morning into the den, and what they do is they put you up in a hotel the night before, and then they take you to the studio at 6 a.m. and you're there with like all the other people. And then you basically go on, like they do like throughout the day, and each have a slot and you go on. So there's people like, the dragons are in there from like 9 a.m. till 5
p.m. And is it like a variety show? There's a man with like a tiny dog and a woman selling like gin.
I mean, there literally is. So there's like a kind of area in the studio where they've all put their stuff. So, you know, I think we had someone who was selling pies. We had a, I think we had a guy who was like homemade gin or something like, and there was a guy who had like a new novel, like plug sockets. Which is actually very cool. But they all have these like setups and they're like, you know, because when you watch Dragon's Den, you see them all the stuff there and all that stuff. And we were like, we're an online business. we haven't got anything. And
I love the idea that you're sat next to people and they're going, so how much are you asking for the Dragons? And they're like $5,000 50% of a business. And you're like, how much are you? It's $90,000 for 1%.
you've got to start high. We got incredibly lucky with all of it. it. But it worked out well because we put a TV on a stand and just had like our website on the picture. And so therefore there was something for people to see. Otherwise, I think it would have been a bit more boring if it was just us standing there.
It wasn't boring at all. And what was amazing is that negotiation, that kind of anchoring incredibly low. You sort of told us casually before that, were you hoping to get a deal? Was it important to coming away, or was it just a lottery ticket?
It was important to get a deal. Like, I think, for a couple of reasons, like, we really wanted to have Dragons on board. We wanted the credibility of having got a dragon, which I think made a big difference to us in terms of, like, you know, consumers seeing the business. And also we wanted to be shown on the show for as long as possible. And the way it works is, you won't be surprised if anybody watches the show, if you get a deal, you get a longer segment than if you don't. I mean, if you don't get a deal, you probably don't get shown, right? Like, that is, as a general rule, that's kind of what happens.
At what point in your company, like from the day it started to Dragons, like how long are you, a year in your company, a year into the company, 2 years?
In terms of before we went on?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't go on until 2018, and we started the business in 2014.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And obviously we had pivoted the business, so we kind of changed the model. But we talked about doing it for like a very, very long time, and never kind of got around to doing it. And then just one day early in 2018, I think I was sitting on the sofa at home. This was just as we'd done Y Combinator out in California, and my brilliant co-founder was out there raising, and I just had a child, so I couldn't be in California. And I was at home, I think, with my baby and watching Dragons Den on a Sunday night, and was just like, or Thursday night, whatever it was on. I think it was on Sunday at that point. And I was just like, oh, sod it. I think we should just go for it. And I just literally got the laptop out there and banged in an application, and then they called us next week, and I was a bit like, okay. It was a bit surprising.
A bit like X Factor, where you've either got to be really good or really bad to get on the TV? Like,
I think there is a little element of that. I think like there's some, I mean, my basic view is I think anybody who's got a consumer-facing business that you can take the product there and then, i.e. you can buy something online or you can download something, it makes total sense. And it's definitely worth doing it. Even if you do get, have a tough time in front of the dragons, you're still getting in front of people that you would never have been in front of.
It was really it was funny because we met you and we knew you to watch it kind of a little bit stood next. It felt like we were like watching it with you, and it was like, they just look so intimidating and so angry. Were you crapping yourself when you were on there? You looked very calm.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely crapping myself. I mean, like, it was, but I mean, so my brilliant, brilliant co-founder, Will, I mean, as you could tell from the show, he kind of slightly led the charge and did more talking than me. He's just way cooler than me. And as in cooler he's very cool as well, but as cool as a cucumber under pressure. And, we were up until like 2 a.m. the night before in the hotel, kind of like practicing the intro and all that kind of stuff. And then we kind of that morning had worked out like where we were willing to, like, because you never obviously get the offer that, you know, you never get what you want at the start. And therefore, what was the plan in terms of like, where were we willing to go down and all that kind of jazz? And we had a plan. And we actually stuck to it, which was kind of like...
What was the worst case for you?
Well, so we were lucky because Will had done a brilliant job just raising money in California after we did Y Combinator, the startup accelerator, and we did that at a certain valuation. And so we went into the den being like, well, we've just raised from, you know, genuinely, you know, Y Combinator invested in Airbnb, you know, Dropbox, it's like got God knows how many unicorns. These are impressive investors. We're not going to just suddenly go way below that for the dragons. So we were able to like make that argument. I mean, the key thing to remember there is that the show is like 12 minutes. You see 12 minutes, and we were filming for 3 hours. So like,
you were in there for three, like, yeah, in front of the dragons for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Would never have guessed that. Jesus.
We went to the wall 3 times. So like, you know, so they all made offers twice. We went to the wall after the first offer, went to the wall after the second offer, and came back, and then it started to cut. And that's when Peter Jones said, you made a terrible mistake.
Were you like, screw you, Peter, we haven't made a terrible mistake? Or were you like, shit, have we made a terrible mistake?
Yeah, we'd be like,
Peter said we've had a terrible mistake.
No, of course you think that. Like, what else? I mean, we weren't like, oh, great, Peter's out. No, we wanted as much competition for as long as possible. You know, he was slightly doing it for TV as well. Like, you could kind of tell, like there's an element of all of that. Also, actually, I think we started at about 10, or maybe it was 10:30, or maybe even 11, and we were kind of going for 3 hours. I think everybody was just really hungry at that point, you know, and hadn't had lunch. And, you know, there was some chat about, like, let's just get on with this. We need a sandwich, you know, like, which is kind of totally fair enough.
I like the idea that you go back to the wall and you're like, I'm really scared and I can't stop sweating. I look professional. Let's pretend we're talking about
this. I'm just so hungry.
Things you can't even do that because they you can hear what they're saying. You know, when you watch the show, you can see, like, you can hear them at the wall. So we knew we were being listened to. I mean, right. The dragons can't hear you, but the TV can. So we were like, well, we can't say anything. You know, we can't be like,
it's just 0.5% and I really want a sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. It's just but we very, so what the other thing was that, the deal you saw on TV was not actually the deal that we did in the den.
Well, that's what I want to ask about, because there's a suspicion, I think, among the viewers that if the dragons get cold feet on a promise they've made in the den, can they just bail on a technicality and say something didn't align with what their understanding of what they heard? And so it's not a real negotiation.
100%. So, like, my understanding is roughly 50% of deals that you see shake on in the den don't go through.
And that's not as bad as I thought it could be, actually.
No, I mean, I think so that happened to a friend of mine, and look, the truth is like, you know, we did it for 3 hours, but actually, you know, they then have to do proper due diligence, right? So then they then looked at our accounts, and they actually, like, and they had a person working for them that did lots of due diligence, and stuff comes out, right? You know, like, it's totally reasonable, I think, for those kind of deals to fall through. But actually what happened with us in the den was that I think it was too complicated for them to show on the show, but what actually happened was that we refused to do the deal that it sounded like we got in the den. Actually, was because we said we couldn't dilute our existing investors, and we'd made an agreement with our existing investors we wouldn't dilute them more than what they had paid for, and therefore we couldn't go below a £6 million valuation. And actually, the deal we ended up doing was at a £4 million valuation. And the reason we did, and we were what happened was we said we can't do it below £6 million. Because we can't dilute our investors. And then Tej suggested, well, why don't, you know, we're not going to do it for 6 million, we'd do it for 4 million, but why don't you, as founders, give us the extra 0.5% from your holdings? So Will and I both gave them 0.5% directly to them, so that just affected us and didn't dilute the rest of the investors. And that was what we actually shook on the den, and that's what the deal was that actually went through. It was, but I can understand why they didn't want to show that on the program, because it was, like, quite confusing. And I've even now, just trying to explain it, I'm a bit confused. So,
no, that seems clear. You're not diluting it, but it's a bigger deal coming out of your own pot, isn't it? And actually, it's good. I think it shows you really want it to an investor if you're willing to give away some of your own piece of the pie as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So you valued it at 9 million. A white combinator in that time.
Because
you went in and the first shot of, I can't remember his name, when you say we want 1% for 90 grand, and you can see him going, like, I love that part. He's like, what, 9 million quid? Sorry, how have you valued this company at 9 million quid?
It always goes down badly. If you can get through that, that's the key thing. But so we raised the Y Combinator at an $8 million valuation, which at the time was a 6 million quid valuation. So we went in at 9 million, knowing you could drop down to 6. That was the plan.
And you then grew the company into a 40-person organization?
Yeah, it was about, when we ended up selling it, it was about 50, 60 people.
And what was it valued at when you sold it?
So we sold it for, all in, it was about 15 million. But there was an earn-out and bits of, you know, complications.
And what's funny is, you know, the future isn't an extrapolation of the past. Now, energy is a completely different conversation. We can't swap to anyone. We can't even afford the provider that's been forced upon me at home. You know, it's funny that when you're looking at a risk of a business like the Dragons were, and we watched that last night, the real risk that comes and gazumps it isn't even on the risk register, is it really? And I just wonder if there's a sort of lesson there that could be learned.
Well, so I think anybody who sells their business is always has sleepless nights about whether they've done the right thing. And we built that by the time I left Go Compare, it'd been like 9 years or no, just under 9 years. And, selling your baby is quite hard. And obviously you also stay up at night thinking, did I get the right price? And could we have made more money? And, slightly ludicrous kind of thoughts, but obviously that kind of stuff keeps you, that does make you think about it. But also kind of like it's quite hot. Like it took that was my entire 30s basically.
At least you got something to show for it, Henry.
Yeah. And, but we got incredibly lucky because we sold it. And I'm very sadly, like all energy switching is now stuffed. And what it is for the short term, I'm hoping that it will come back. But we were going through very, very difficult times. Now, if we still ran the business, we got incredibly lucky.
It's amazing that you've to take something from what just you two to 50 people in what do you say 9 years?
So it was kind of start of 2014, and then we sold it in the summer of 2019, and then we left in 2021. If you see what I mean. Maybe it's not quite 9 years. I think it's probably longer than I think.
At risk of a very ugly shoehorn here. Yeah. Ben has started working with something called Reach UK that I'm sure tell us about. But these are technology companies of 50 or 60 people who have no physical space or place to work, and they all seem very comfortable with it. And I wondered if you were running your business now, if that would have been something you'd have done.
This is a great shoehorn. I love it. Well, I'll
what? What shoehorn? That's beautiful.
Yeah, the segue was magnificent.
Flowing water.
No, but this is really important, and I've been thinking about it a bit. So in terms of what we did, so we got very lucky in the sense that one of our investors gave us some office space to begin with. Which actually, I mean, and also, you know, we were, you know, the first couple of years it was very, very tough, and if we'd had to pay for office space, we might well have had to go, we might well have gone under. Being in an office made quite a big difference for us, and in particular, it was we were kind of in his office, so we were like in an office with lots of other people. So like while we were kind of stressing out, we could see the calm of this like office and other people working, and so it was like it just was a really good stabilizer. And then as we grew, we ended up leaving, we went into a kind of shared office space in Vauxhall, and it was like we were in there with like lots of other startups, and there was a really nice vibe, and we went from 6 people to 60 people in there, and they were like, we were able to grow in there, and it was amazing. And I have very, very fond memories of that.
What was that place?
It was called the Handbag Factory, just in Vauxhall. And you know, it was slightly rough around the edges, but it also, you know, it had the startup stuff. It had like a kind of slightly ropey gym and a ping pong table and drinks on a Friday.
Glorious.
It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, not, you know, in the summer it was too hot, and in the winter it was too cold. And, you know, it was like that kind of classic stuff. I think they've sorted all of that stuff out. Please, everybody, Handbag Factory, don't get upset with me.
No, but it sounds like they were doing what, you know, it's a place for innovation, and actually that's it's not about your air conditioning facilities. It's about getting the right people and creating an atmosphere of fun and innovation and a place where you want to be.
100%. And they were incredibly good to us in the sense that, you know, we turned up with 5 people, and then like about a month later we were like, we need to have, you know, 18 more desks, and they were like, right, okay, well, we'll work it out.
It's a great problem for them to have, isn't it? Just more people than they can deal
with. Exactly. But I think like my favorite times of the business was like in that period when we were small, but we were growing together quickly, and we were physically together. I have no issue with remote working. I think it basically is more beneficial to people kind of my age, like who perhaps have kids and have been in their career for a while, and they've got connections, and they're in their kind of late 30s and 40s. I think it's less beneficial to people who are early in their career, and it's harder to make connections, I think, online. I think there's lots of good tech coming around to kind of like improve that. And I think one of the big advantages startups have is moving very quickly. And communication is like such an important part of that. And us all being, you know, being all around the same table just allows you to create a kind of camaraderie, a speed of movement. You know, you don't need to be there 5 days a week, but like that ability to be together, I think, it, you know, what is the one advantage a startup has over a big corporation? Fundamentally is speed. And how do you optimize for speed? Well, the truth is you put everybody in the same room together, is my view. Now, other people have other views. I think you can build incredible, huge startups and do incredible things remotely, but my preference is for everybody to be there.
Yeah, that's what surprises so much. I mean, the Reach UK, when I went to their kind of mentoring talk.
What is Reach UK?
Maybe Reach UK, they're part of a big Canadian investment company, and they invest in prop tech, and they have a London arm, they have a Canadian arm, and they kind of mentor small companies to like build them up. But you know, when I started talking to some of the companies afterwards, I was really shocked that there were 60 people, which in an architectural profession, 60 people, you're a big practice at 60. You have offices, you have huge amount of infrastructure required. Whereas they were 80 months old, and I was like, do you not have an office? And they were like, no, we work remotely. We come in once a week. Like as a village hall, we bring everyone together, but everyone works remotely. And I was like, do you want an office? He was like, why? That's so much risk and pressure on us for like overheads. And we work brilliantly remotely, and we're scaling up. You know, 1 week we were 40, then we were 65, and it gave them total flexibility. And I was just so surprised that the tech world just moved. It's so, the way it moves is just so fast, and you know, it could be sold and changed to a different company. Whereas I think the more traditional property companies, I have a very different model, and it was interesting, you know, trying to find out when do companies transition to an office, if at all. Mm. You know, if you're a 60 or 100 person startup, or a company that might have a 10 million pound turnover, you might still not want an office.
Yeah, I mean, totally.
How big does a tech company have to get before they? I mean, want there are huge.
There are $1 billion businesses that are still totally remote. Like, you know, I think WordPress is like completely remote. Like the company, I think it's automatic that the company that owns that.
It's
massive $1 billion business, and I think it's horses for courses, right? Like I think it does work quite well for tech companies. I don't think it necessarily works for all companies. I think there are disadvantages and advantages. I think one of the big problems with it is like you have to, like, I think the reason it works for something like WordPress is they were remote from the start. They were just like, right, we're gonna be remote, and we're gonna like make sure our systems are set up for remote, and therefore they do a lot. They actually do a lot of in-person stuff as well. I mean, I don't know if they specifically do, but my understanding is that people who are like remote first do also like, you know, the town hall stuff, but they also like meet regularly in a way that you don't do if you're all sat together. I think where it goes wrong is when you see companies are just like, oh, we're gonna kind of do a hybrid solution that they haven't really thought about, and they're not either like in person or they're not remote, and the whole thing is like, oh, we, you know, I think one of the things that drives me a bit mad is kind of like meetings where some are in the room and some are on the screen, and it's just like, this is, you know, this isn't really working, and some, you know, and people are on laptop and they're like, okay, well, and therefore I think people are kind of reinventing this stuff in a very clever way. But you've got to think about it from first principles. Like, you know, if we're going to be remote first, what are the principles behind doing that, and how does that work, and take it from there. I think just kind of like moving things from moving like how you did stuff in person to remote is just kind of, you know, and I think we all went through this during COVID. I mean, my business certainly did. And it just doesn't necessarily work as well as you'd hoped it would.
Do you think, well, we were talking about this yesterday, this idea that you don't really have much of a culture when you work remotely. And I mean, Bill and I were at a big practice for 10 years, and we felt really invested in that company, and it was part of our family. You know, we were, you know, it was really hard to leave that place because we loved it. Whereas I think if you work remote, you just turn your laptop off, move to a different company, and now you're working at this other company. And do you have such a sense of self-worth if you're just a hired gun and a software guy? I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, look, I think that's one of the problems. I think software engineers, and specifically those, like, it's a bit trickier because they don't actually want to be, you know, if you're like coding 8 hours a day, you don't really want to be in the office because someone kind of keeps coming up to you and ignore, you know, you're doing deep work and you need to be like shut off from other people to be able to do that. And therefore remote actually works extremely well.
I think this is the not quite the Wild West, but we're in a period of change and no one's quite figured out what the new reality looks like. I kind of want to, you know, you have a political background, and so you can speak on behalf of government here. Or at least
I definitely can't do that.
or at least have a view. And I, you know, I've seen in Portugal that they've made it illegal for a boss to text you after working hours. There is a bill in place in the UK to oblige employers to provide a hybrid solution. You know, my gut is that this should be market led, and depending on the product, has a big impact on how work should work, and we're all going to figure that out together. Does it feel the right place for government to get involved?
I mean, you saw me raising my eyes. So, I mean, no, I don't think it is really. I think it's it's we're all a if government itself had worked it out, which I don't think it has, in the sense of like what they do with their own staff. Then maybe I would think that they can, they could tell us what to do. But like, I'm not sure that's right, because there's so many variety of businesses, so many people doing it in lots of different ways. And actually, if people want to be fully in person, they should be allowed to. And it kind of seems, frankly, ludicrous that is even being discussed. But I guess this is. It's good to have a discussion. I just hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just one of those things. It's to present as current and that we know what the national conversation is rather than an actual legislative change. But
yeah, maybe. I mean, we'll see. I don't know, who knows?
So I'm still fascinated that you've come from like startup tech world and now you're a non-exec at Hornby Models, which in my head must be one of the most traditional and oldest companies. What's that transition been like?
I've only been lucky enough to be on the board of Hornby since January, so it's still, I'm still trying to like get my feet under the, I'm a non-exec, so it's not really feet under the table, but like trying to understand the business and how it works.
Never mind the business, trying to figure out how the actual products work. I bought one for Frank.
Scalectrics.
No, maybe subconsciously after we first met, but I then ran out of ideas for his fourth birthday and bought a Hornby train set, and it is up and running, and I'm teasing because it works beautifully. I've played on it far more than Frank, which I think is the underlying.
Does he like it?
He loves it. I mean, four is small.
Yeah, it is.
And if I had a gripe, well, Lucy's gripe is that it's now through the app. So you have to put it through the iPad, whereas a four-year-old probably wants to just press stop and go. So it's a bit not quite analog. But now we've got that running, he loves it. And I love it. And we all just sit there watching it go round and round. And it is fantastic. So there is a timelessness to the actual product. But that's...
Does he want more of it? Does he want to like expand the set and stuff? Or actually is he just kind of done with that one?
I don't think he yet able to conceive of what's possible. Yeah. Yet. So we've just got the simple leap.
It is your startup. Four is young.
Yeah.
That's great, though. I was very, very pleased.
If Frank comes in, I'm going to be like, Frank, what do you think of the Hornby train set? He'll be like, what? What train set? Oh, Daddy's train set. Yeah, I love it.
Well, we did it. I mean, I want to hear your views on this, but we did it as a case study on business school as how the... who you thought your customer was, it wasn't. You know, you were making them for children, and then you outsourced the production to a Chinese manufacturer that suddenly started making them in a lot more detail. Or this is how the case study presents to us, and making the trains with a lot more detail on them, and then they saw sales rise, and it was appealing to a kind of heritage or an older nostalgic market who were richer and had more money to invest. And then it had this resurgence, and I'm sure it's got commercial challenges now that are completely different to that. But does that ring true?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know the ins and outs of that exact situation, but I think one of the really cool things about it is that it's a combination of two great industries, because it's collectibles and then it's also toys. And like each of the products are kind of like a bit more focused on which of it. So, I mean, the thing to remember about Hornby is that it's not just Hornby, which is an amazing, incredible brand, but it's also Scalectrics, it's Airfix, it's Corgi Cars, it's Humbrol, the paint, and then they've also got brands in Germany and Spain and France, so there's the kind of, it's very, very cool.
I'm getting waves of nostalgia.
Yeah, exactly.
Scalectrics are the best.
So the one I really like at the moment is Micro Scalectrics, which is like a kind of slightly smaller version of Scalectrics. And there was a Batman and Joker one That they'd released for Christmas last year, which I got my nephews, and it's really great because the cards don't fall off as much. It's like it's meant to be for younger kids, so you can really hold the accelerator down, and it basically doesn't fall off the track. And they were doing things like putting it upside down and like having the cars going around upside down. I was like, how's that working? But they loved it. But like that, so that kind of stuff is the kind of like. But it's not easy as a business because you've got kind of like the collecting gang who are a bit older, and then you've got the kind of toy gang and who are young kids, and you kind of have to take the young ones on the journey to try and get them to that place, and you know, so it's harder in the sense that you're kind of like appealing to two audiences rather than just like smashing through, you know, kind of focusing on one. But that's also the great thing about it.
It's interesting because I guess like Lego had a similar thing where they like they've just transitioned to making amazing, very prescriptive sets. But like part of the fun is when you get a Scalextric track, it's just making some random thing with it. And there's a Frank, like with the train set, you're like, it has to be exactly this way. I'm like that when I give my kids Lego. They're like, no, it's not what the instructions say. Like, I'm really militant with them. No, right, let me do it. I'll do it. You're not doing it properly.
But I the like Millennium that. Falcon does not look like yeah. that.
It doesn't have a thing on the side.
That is brilliant, though, that journey. The journey from toy to collectible. So your entry product has got to feel, it's got to be up and running quite quickly and give it some sort of day one satisfaction. But it's got to have enough kind of creativity that you could... It's that sort of, they call it the IKEA effect. The more you are involved in something's creation and construction, the more value you apportion to it. And I can see the Hornby ties into that because actually you're painting the figurines and you're creating papier-mâché mountains for it to go around. And the more you invest, the more happy you are to pay a lot for a switching track. And no, I think I'm well on this journey.
It started, Bill, hasn't it? It started.
Do it.
How different is like being Ned on the cabinet office then compared to being a startup? I'd imagine it's one extreme to the other, just total whiplash.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, being a Ned of government is a bit odd in itself because the non-executive directors in businesses have actual power, and like in the sense that they can do things and change things, and they have to hold the board to account and all that kind of stuff. Whereas in government, it's kind of like, well. You don't have any power to get rid of anybody, and nor should you. You know, like this is a democracy, and you know, so you're kind of trying to hold people to account, but they don't really answer to you in the sense of it like that. So it's a tricky one, and I mean, Neds have been around for a while. Tony Blair introduced them, but like I think they're still slightly finding their way in terms of like what is their role and what is their best purpose. And I think it's a lot of it's down to the Secretary of State and how he wants to use them, and also the permanent secretary and all of that. I think in worst case they're just kind of for show, and best case they really kind of add a lot of value and can kind of help push things in the right direction. But I kind of, you know, I did a fair few years in government earlier in my career, and it was a reminder, going back to government was kind of a reminder of the bureaucracy and how things, you know, it is tough, you know, when you do a startup. Even when I left this business, we were about 160 people, and things still move pretty fast at that size. And then you kind of get into government and it's like, okay, this is slow. But it's slow for a reason, you know, and for good reasons. You know, I sometimes think we could move faster, but it's definitely a different way.
Okay, well, I'm going to say maybe just last question then. Could you, we were talking before about this investment company you were giving us advice on, and you were like, do you remember just before?
Entrepreneur first.
Yeah. Explain what that was again.
Oh, I mean, I don't give them advice. But so Entrepreneur First, so I think, yeah, we were talking about a startup who are doing Entrepreneur First. And so Entrepreneur First is like a startup accelerator that takes, you basically apply to it. And they take, I think, about 60 people twice a year. And then they put them together to create businesses. And the idea is that if you want to do a startup, you don't have a co-founder, you don't even have an idea. You apply to this, you'll meet other people in this very similar situation who've probably got very different skills to you, because they look for people who have got technical skills, and it is hard to get in. So you've got to have done stuff in the past, and you've got to have got something about you. And then they kind of like, it's like a kind of matchmaking service. You kind of like, you know, hang out with these other people, and then you meet one, and then you might work with them for a week or two, and then you'd be like, oh, it doesn't really work, and then you go to someone else or whatever it is. And they've got this incredible track record. And then the ones that come up with good ideas, they'll fund and they'll invest in them. And then those businesses will go and raise investment themselves, VC money, and entrepreneur investors will help them do it. And they've got an incredible track record, having built these companies. And I think what, you know, the thesis is like, actually, you know, you can put people together and create incredible connections that wouldn't have happened otherwise, and you can build incredible businesses. And it's about putting great people together, because previously everybody's theory was like, oh, you know, a co-founder needs to be someone you've known for years and you worked with before, and actually they were just took that kind of total given hypothesis that everybody agreed with and just said, actually, is that right, and actually, can we expand the market? And they're global now. They're incredible. You know, they're raising huge amounts of money, and they've done incredibly well. And I'm a huge fan of what they've done. But it's a great example of just thinking, you know, going back to first principles and thinking about it things a little bit differently. And then just trying to, you know, I don't think there's any limit on the amount of kind of, you know, I think for young people today, like, startup building is the most exciting thing you can do. And it's not as scary and as unsafe as it was in the past. And it's just brilliant seeing more of this stuff happening. It's really exciting.
And is it a bit like VC? It's sort of slightly codifying the process, not to take the fun and creativity out of it, but to take some of the risk out of it, or, you know, the pressure. I can certainly see being, whether it's part of the handbag factory or something like Entrepreneur First, having all that experience in the room means you can go even faster than the speed that you inherently have. It sounds brilliant. Henry, thank you. That was really inspiring and interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.